Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Wednesday, February 22nd. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And my name is Hesse Harris. I'm your host. And we're scheduled to interview Chuck Lesnik. He's the president of the Yonkers City Council. He's already served 6 years in that capacity and has 2 more years to go. So it's going to be very interesting to inaugurate his first show with us, and that's really quite exciting. And in order for us to really delve into these next few years ahead of us with him, we've decided at his accession, so to speak, to do a show with us every 2 weeks. And so this will be the inaugural show. It'll be on Wednesdays, and we'll continue from there. And so it'll be very interesting to learn what's on his radar screen, what he's already accomplished, what his visions are into the future. And in doing so, we'll learn a great deal of the plans and the direction of the Yonkers City Council. So I want to welcome Chuck Lesnik to the show. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Hesse. Pleasure to be on this new medium, Blog Talk Radio.
Absolutely. It's great. And I'm so thrilled that you're on, because I was just telling our listeners, you've already had 6 years in office, and that's quite a span of time. And there are 2 more years, at least in this particular office, for you. And I was wondering if you could reflect on some of the accomplishments of the past 6 years that you feel has impacted the community, and also what your plans are for the future. Do you see a different vision, a different concept? Have times changed and required a different thinking process? And there's a whole lot to really cover, but basically it's your understanding of the landscape, so to speak.
But, you know, the landscape has changed. When I first joined the council following the 2005 election, most of the council members on the council had been in office for 4, 5, 6 years, and even those who had not been in office had previous government experience. Like Dee Barbato and Liam McLaughlin, and later on Joan Grunowski, all had government experience before coming to the city council. Now I look around the city council, and we've got 3 guys who have been there for 2 years and 3 brand-new guys. So, you know, there are benefits to shuffling the deck, same thing with the new mayor. But I also find myself in the experience as the institutional knowledge sometimes of having been around for a long time. We, as you know, reorganized the city council. Wilson Turo is the majority leader. John Larkin, the minority leader. We have a few different committees. One of the things that I'm actually looking forward to a lot is a responsibility that the council gave the council president during our reorganization, and that is to develop a legislative tracking system. Up to now, you've had to basically call up the clerk and rely on her memory as to where an item was and what committee it was in, and bills were never assigned numbers until after they actually passed, and I understand why, because you have to keep it sequential, but you couldn't follow a bill's progress like you can in New York City and through their city council. So we've actually been talking to the company Granicus that does the New York City council, and hopefully we can finally realized what I've said 3 years ago I wanted to do, which was to have streaming video to accompany our council minutes, so that years from now, if you're following, you know, a bill like the steep slope legislation, you want to find out what the legislative intent was, you'll be able to track its past history through the committees and then click on the actual, you know, 5, 10, 15-minute segment of a particular city council meeting where council members were discussing it, so you can actually hone in on what they were trying to do. So that's a thing I'm very excited about. You know, looking back at the last 6 years as a whole, there are certain things that we worked very hard on that in the end of the day didn't didn't pan out, and there are certain things that we worked very hard on that did pan out and sort of paved the way for more economic development. I think that while Ridge Hill certainly dominates the recent economic development accomplishments, it's huge. It's generating jobs. It's generating excitement. It's generating income tax and sales tax. SFC dominated a lot of time, and it remains to be seen when that project will actually commence and in what form it'll take, and whether the S, the F, the C will still be players when it is ultimately built. I do believe that it will be built in some form. I think the Alexander Street planning corridor was a tremendous opportunity, and I'm very optimistic that that will move forward as the economy picks up. I think the downtown master plan, and even though it was passed in the waning days of the Amicone administration, with council input, reduced parking requirements downtown, increased some density for transit-oriented developments, and I think that in turn will lead to a revitalized downtown. You know, some of this stuff doesn't happen overnight. You have to lay the groundwork and then see how it grows.
Well, let me just stop you for a moment, because there's so much that you're saying, and it's really a wonderful synopsis that you're creating. And we should tell people that we're speaking to Chuck Lesnik. He's the president of the Yonkers City Council, and he's with us today. And so, when you talk about the laying the groundwork for all these things, and all these projects, is there really continuity as we change the city council, or do we get such a different demeanor, such a different prospect based on the new people that are there, or do they too feel somehow almost encumbered in a good way, I would hope, with regard to the history of the projects and the visions that were laid out there before them? So does that change, and does that cause the city council to become a little bit unraveled, or is it able to maintain its focus?
The good news is that even the new guys on the council came out of community roots. You know, Mike Sabatino was with the Committee for Smart Growth. John Larkin was with Pierre at Gray Oaks Civic Association. Even Dennis Shepard and Michael Breen were with community groups. Wilson Torero was on the CDA. So they have been following this stuff. So they're not brand spanking new, but they have been following it. You know, it's funny. Last night, the city council did confirmation hearings on several commissioners that Mayor Spano has put forward. And two of them were returning to Yonkers after stints elsewhere. Jeffrey Williams, who's the new planning commissioner, or at least will be confirmed, I expect, next week, worked with me back in the late 80s, early 90s in the Yonkers planning department. He was an architectural draftsman at the time, but he later went on to work for the county planning department and then became commissioner of planning and development in Mount Vernon before returning to his hometown of Yonkers. And, Jeffrey really saw a lot of the early days where we worked together on visioning what downtown would look like, acquiring the HUD funds to get the Yonkers City Pier, that whole thing that prompted the development. And that downtown development has come in bits and spurts. There'll be a lot for a year or two, and then quiet for a year or two, and then there's more for a year or two. So, it's had a steady upward progress. Jeffrey also comes out of the Landmarks movement, and he was head of the Yonkers Historic Society for years, and he recognizes the balance between new and old and keeping downtown interesting by preserving the old properties. So I think he'll be a great addition. He certainly knows what's going on, and he's had the opportunity to also observe Yonkers as a somewhat outsider in his diaspora from Yonkers, and now he comes back. Paula Red Zeman was proposed, and the council wants to move her forward next week also as resources commissioner. And Paula brings a tremendous wealth of knowledge from the county, where she revamped many of the titles changed the way the county did tests, so it was more of a continual process instead of, you know, waiting for a particular test, the police test, the fire test, the computer technician test to come up at a certain point and then waiting for them to pick you, more of a rolling basis that made county government more responsive and more able to hire people quickly. And for some quirky reason, I don't know why, the Human Resource Department, the Human Resource Commissioner in Yonkers also oversees the MIS Department. It probably historically fell out that way because somebody had an interest, but that's real good because Paula, when she was with the Board of Elections and with the county clerk, led a number of initiatives to automate and with the clerk, you know, bring back records from 100, 200 years back online. And that's exactly what we need to do when we move forward with our legislative tracking system, because not only are we going to move it forward prospectively so you can see where bills wind up, but then we're going to do a look back, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years at a time to get some of the old bills online so that we can, you know, have a better historic record. Because sometimes we'll be talking about something in the Yonkers City Council and we'll say, didn't we do that 10 years ago? Didn't we do that 5 years ago? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there may actually be a bill on the books that is being enforced, is not being enforced, is being utilized, whatever. So it's good to know what the full history is.
What are there things still left unscrutinized from the past that we need to look into as we move into the future, or are we looking toward issues that will cause the city to focus more on other issues like concerns about economic development with regard to the waterfront? And I don't know if the court cases that are presently before us, if they will stymie some of that, you know, that focus into new economic development. So where do we stand on a lot of these issues? Not particularly the court case, but just where is the city heading, and how will we be affected by other stimulus outside that we can't control?
Well, you know, the mayor has spoken about the deficit that the city has, and it's, you know, it's about $40-50 million on the municipal side. It's $22 million on the education side, just to keep the status quo. And if you want to return to where we were before the drastic cuts of last year, where we had to let go, you know, over 200 teachers, it would be another $39 million. So, you know, we're dealing with the budget issues, and you know, the mayor and I have been going up to Albany so far separately, although we plan to go up together. I was just up there this past weekend for the Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus with some of the other council members, and we've been planning to go with the mayor to talk to the governor's budget staff and the assembly and the Senate budget people. You know, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot out there. But Yonkers will do well with some of the Regional Economic Development Council initiatives and some of the competitions that the governor has set up for additional funds for school districts. I'm glad that the unions were able to work out their differences with the administration, both in Yonkers and statewide, in regard to teacher evaluations, because I would hate to have seen money held up unnecessarily because of that. But, yeah, when you talk about going back and looking at past decisions, there were a series of past decisions of how money was spent in the city when we got the $300 million from the housing settlement and, you know, the education settlement, and basically spent that money all up front and didn't really increase the tax base going forward. So that we wouldn't have some of these issues. There were a lot of one-shots, spin-ups, selling library buildings and things like that that caused us to be where we are. And in some cases, there were very valid reasons for why the mayor and sometimes the council did this together because they needed to fill a budget gap for a particular year. But it has left us in a place where we're very vulnerable economically, but again, no place that we have not been before. You know, the assessment rolls in Yonkers have diminished by over $100 million over the last 15 years. You know, it was close to $700 million, I'm sorry, billion dollars. It goes down. It's diminished over the past 15 years. And part of that is due to the fact that we have not done reval, and we seem to
That's the whole thing too. Because I think wasn't it last year that the city approved a $25 million bond in order to pay for the revaluations,
and yet I think what we approved was closer to $35 million for tax certiorari.
It was
3 years of tax certiorari sort of rolled into one refinancing because there had been some short-term bonds, bans over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's undisputed that we've lost between $10 and $15 million every year for the past 3 or 4 years due to tax certiorari, that the number of SCAR challenges are way up, and that we all believe that we would reduce our costs of defending our values if we did reval on a regular 4-year cycle like most states do and many municipalities even within New York State do. The question is how to get there. The previous city council, although Joan Granowski and I very much wanted to do reval immediately, just Yonkers go forward, the previous city council voted 7-0 to do it in the context of a countywide reval. I think that some of the attitudes are changing now with the mayor and the new council, and that, you know, as we see the collaborative assessment report that the county legislators sponsored with the Westchester municipal officials, they actually put some money into it. We'll be drawing some of that money down soon to start bringing the data up to speed. And I think there's a philosophy among all those in government now that this is something that has to be done. And the sooner it can be done, the better. Peekskill is looking at it right now. Mamaroneck is looking at it. Other villages have done it. Bronxville, Pelham, Rye. The results have been good. So, you know, I think that is something that we're slowly inching towards and will help us with our long-term financial problems.
Am I wrong? I thought that the governor had said that in his budget, should it be approved supposedly by the 1st of April, that the city of Yonkers was expecting to get a $72 million one shot, so to speak. Does that help our financial situation? Or am I wrong about the numbers? I could be wrong about the numbers.
Yeah, I thought the number was more like $7 million more. We were certainly going to get 3 or 4% more on our education money. So, you know, since education is more than half of our budget, whatever 3 or 4% increase is, maybe that was where that $7-9 million. Figure was, you know, we're trying to get more. We're trying to make the argument that compared to some of the other school districts that have seen either a flat enrollment or a decrease in enrollment, and Yonkers has gone up, that there should be some accounting for the change in numbers. And that's the biggest argument that we make, along with the fact that we have a high percentage of students who have English as a second language, high percentage of students who qualify for free lunch and therefore are living below the poverty line. And that's another thing we want to do, change that poverty line. One of the things we're looking at doing is bring back the living wage bill that the council Democrats twice passed and the previous mayor vetoed twice. The current mayor during the campaign said that he would support a living wage bill. So, you know, the question is just what that living wage bill will be, what the council proposes in conjunction with the mayor's office, and what ultimately gets signed. So this is stuff that I hope will happen in the future.
Well, wanted to ask you about the makeup of the city council. Forget the personalities, but just look at the numbers. I guess you could say the Democrats were blessed again with having a 4-person majority out of 7. That's not a foolproof majority. It's not the super majority of 5-2 that would negate any possibility of an override by the mayor. But even in the mayor, you have a Democrat. Are the Democrats going to be using their clout? Because before we didn't find such a heavy-handed political perspective from the majority. Maybe some people will believe that there was, but you know, it just didn't seem to be as heavy-handed as we see in some other municipalities or even on the county level. So do you sense a different change? Because I sense to some extent a very vocal as opposed to mostly a silent Republican sector from years past. You know, the same people that are on there now are a little bit different than before, but they certainly were a lot quieter.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to ignore personalities when you're talking about the council members. They all, you know, come to the position from different places. You know, the current majority leader, for instance, happens to be, you know, very much in favor of being a conciliator. You know, in the past, as council president, I often filled that role as conciliator after the majority and minority leader, you know, spoke their pieces. The mayor himself, as a former Republican turned Democrat, is very sensitive towards bipartisan government and doesn't really want to alienate, you know, 30% of the city is Republican, 40% of it Democratic, and the rest are not in any particular party, whatever the ratio is. He's the mayor of all the people. When he's a campaigner, that's one thing, but as mayor, you govern for everybody. So, you know, we've tried to be respectful of the minority. There are certain things that are going to be partisan, whether it be, you know, appointments to the BAR or ultimately when we do redistricting, that will be a very partisan thing. But when we do nonpartisan things, I think the budget is nonpartisan. And, you know, again, technically we only need 4 votes plus the mayor to pass a budget. If the capital budget is 5 votes plus the mayor. If the mayor needs us to go above the 2% property tax cap, then we'll need 5 votes on the city council. Now, up to now, the mayor has said that he believes in a 2% property tax cap. He thinks the taxpayers don't want to pay more than that. He ran on that platform. He supported the governor when he proposed that, and he'd like to try to keep in that 2% range. That's dependent on us getting aid from Albany. That's dependent on us getting cooperation from our friends in labor. And, you know, again, the fact that the mayor refers to them as his friends in labor, the previous mayor didn't always have that attitude towards labor, may mean that we'll get more cooperation from our friends than from our adversaries. So, again, you know, let's see how this cooperative approach works. But, you know, keep the communication open with the Republicans. Look, every appointment the mayor has made so far has received unanimous support. That's a good thing. You know, we've vetted people, we've asked questions, but at the end of the day, we've all come together for the good of the city because, you know, we recognize the role of the administration and the role of the council in moving things forward. So, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, continue with 90% of our votes being unanimous or near unanimous. And, you know, the other votes, there'll be some party line votes on a few things. I'm hoping that we can craft an affordable housing ordinance that we'll all be supportive of. But I do know that in the past, that's been more of a Democratic initiative than not. But I'm hoping when we talk about issues like collaborative tax assessment, that becomes a collaborative, unanimous, or near unanimous proposal.
Does the city council, we're speaking to Chuck Lesnick, who's the president of the Yonkers City Council. I wanted to ask you, does the city council have purview, for example, over the non-collection of funds from past overdue real estate taxes that weren't paid? Does that come as part of your purview, or is that supposed to be something that comes out of the mayor's office in order to promote the collection? Because there are millions and millions of dollars there that we've never collected.
Right. So, the administration might propose methods. We actually talked about this the other day. There was a particular settlement that was coming forward on a particular property that the Corporation Council had negotiated. And, you know, basically the position of the council is we would like to get money back. We want to be uniform in our approach. We don't want to treat anybody differently than anybody else. We actually did start a process back in the last administration of going after some of these properties, these in rem properties, and forcing people into a situation where they're either going to lose their property or settle. And, you know, we may or may not decide in the future, to have some sort of tax amnesty for a limited period of time where people can pay all their back taxes but not incur the penalties. Whatever we do, we have to be open, we have to be transparent, we have to make it available for everybody. We can't, favor any one group of people, one particular taxpayer. But again, the goal in all of these tax forgiveness things, well, number one, the state doesn't let you forgive taxes. There are limitations to what you're allowed to do. It's only interest and penalties that you can sometimes forgive. But the goal is to get money into the coffers without encouraging future taxpayers to be delinquent on their taxes in the hopes that they'll get some deal down the line. So you always have to draw that balance. There always has to be enough incentive for people to pay what they owe. And, again, if it's money that's not coming into the coffers, we have to, look for creative ways of shaking it loose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that would help us certainly financially to get us out of our own hole. Is there anything that we can look at that we can focus in regard to education? That's one of the other big areas of concern in the city.
Well, I would very much like to see us go back to full day pre-K. I think that half day pre-K doesn't work as well. That by the time parents drop off their kids at school, they sort of have to turn around and pick them up. Maybe they can run a few errands while the kids are gone. But, in terms of freeing working parents up so that they can, have another job and bring food home to their families while the kids are at school, it doesn't really accomplish that goal. There are some after-school programs that fill some of those needs, but it's, somewhat disruptive to the children to have to take them from a pre-K environment and then to a after-school environment. So it would be better if we could go back to full-day pre-K. That requires hiring more teachers, which I'd like to see happen. I continue to want to see music and art and sports enhanced. Again, the superintendent did not cut it out last year, but it's been pretty bare bones for a while. And there are programs, again, stepping in to fill the void, like YTI, Youth Theater Interactions, and a few other theater programs around. Some sports programs, obviously, the whole club sports in Yonkers, more boys and girls clubs, the Colts, the Richards, all those sorts of groups fill some of that void. But I'd like to see more in the schools and a better utilization of the school buildings as community centers, as community resources in each community. One of the things that's kind of exciting is a discussion the superintendent has begun on what they call P3s, which are these public-private partnerships, which would potentially enable us to rebuild some of the crumbling schools that we have. We have close to 40 schools in Yonkers, and a dozen of them were built before the last century. And when I say last century, I'm not talking about the 1900s, I'm talking about the 1800s. And while I love historic buildings, buildings built in the 1880s, 1890s, that have not been cared for need to be updated and renovated. And ironically, some of those buildings are more solid than the buildings that were built a dozen years ago here in the city. So we have a whole mix of buildings that we have to improve. The idea of these P3s is that, you might bring in private money, and the private developers, the private investors, will build, design build standards. They won't have to do the same sort of RFPs that sometimes government gets burdened down with. They still will do project labor agreements to use union labor and ensure high quality of work, but they believe that they won't have as many change orders because they'll, the company that bids on the project will be responsible for the completion and the maintenance of the project, which again they believe will.
Well, I wanted to ask you about all those things because you covered so much ground, but just give me a moment. We need to play a commercial from the Westchester Broadway Theater, and we'll be right back in about a minute's time.
Wonderful.
One of the most unique shows ever is coming to the Westchester Broadway Theater on March 1st. Their exciting production of the new Gershwin musical, Wonderful. The singing and dancing sensation that follows five separate storylines through five memorable eras. New York in the 20s, Paris in the 30s, Hollywood in the 40s, New Orleans in the 50s, and right up to today. And it features over 40 of the all-time Gershwin classics, like Someone to Watch Over Me, I've Got a Crush on You, I Got Rhythm. They Can't Take That Away from Me, and of course, Wonderful.
No, they can't.
As part of the WBT's 2012 season, with more musicals more often, Wonderful is playing for 4 weeks only, so you'll want to make your reservations early. And don't forget, before the show, you'll enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of six entrees and all for one low price. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Don't miss the singing and dancing sensation that is Swonderful, the new Gershwin musical. March 1st through March 25th only, and only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, thanks. We're back with Chuck Lesnick, the Yonkers City Council president. We're speaking to him about a lot of issues.
I was doing the Gershwin tunes on the commercial.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You talk about the Westchester Broadway Theater and the Gershwin film they're doing there, the Gershwin production they're doing there is one of theirs. But this month they actually rented out the place to a not-for-profit group that was doing Big River, which is about Huck Finn and Tom's and Jim's travels down the Mississippi. And a number of those kids are local Yonkers or Greenberg kids, and they did it because of Black History Month. They wanted to, you know, have a discussion about the racism of that day and compare it to what's happened today and just sort of the friendship between Jim and Huck that sort of transcends the racism. It was a great production. It's still in production.
Wonderful.
One of the most unique shows ever is coming to the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Sorry about that. I pressed the wrong button.
So I do recommend folks check out Big River, and which happens to be at the Westchester Broadway Theater. So while you did your commercial, I did another one.
That's really good. Well, that's all good. I wanted to get back to you about the education issue that you brought up, which is the pre-K. And even though it's a wonderful concept, that seems to be a lot of what's on the platform quite often in Yonkers politics. We talk about all the things that we want, and we do little planning in order to get it done. And this becomes really an onerous challenge because we don't have the financial wherewithal to do it. And unless there is another way of doing it that is just not divulged to the public, because the public would love to have it, I'm sure. Certainly, there's a need by the student body and those that are coming into the schooling system. But at the same time, these just don't work pragmatically. How do we change that equation? Because, you know, let's face it, we've been talking about this for 20 years. And it's not just on this particular issue of pre-K, but on so many others, and we're not planning. And or maybe we're just losing too much money on another end of the process, so we can't afford it. And how do we get over this hump, so to speak?
Well, you know, again, 19 of those last 20 years, we've had full-day pre-K. And full-day pre-K came to Yonkers sooner than it came to most municipalities because it was implemented as part of the settlement to the DSED because Back then, people thought, and now we actually have evidence that it improves test scores for not only inner-city kids, but all kids. It really is the great equalizer of people of different income means and educational backgrounds. You know, again, if you want to try to predict how kids will do on their SATs, the biggest indicator is to look at the parents' tax returns and the parents' graduate degrees, because the children of educated people who are also wealthy people tend to do better than the children of those who are not in first generation. Now, Yonkers always had a history of first generation families making it through, breaking barriers, and doing great things, but we want that to be the rule, not the exception. Mm-hmm. You know, with our exceptional students. So pre-K is one of those things that evidence shows works. Now, how do we get the resources for it? Well, you know, little of that is going back up to the state where the former assemblyman, now mayor, has very good contacts. And another part of that is a more cooperative approach with labor. And, you know, again, not to, you know, take away from anybody's motivations, anytime you shuffle the deck, you get a new outcome. And, you know, by the time the last administration left, some of the feelings that they had towards unions and vice versa were sort of set in stone. So it made it harder to get certain concessions. Now we have cooperation, at least for now, until people start taking positions. And there may be better ways to achieve savings that maybe either weren't thought about before or was thought about and never pursued. So, you know, I'm optimistic. The mayor is actually looking to announce tomorrow, Thursday, his education redesign team. And there will be, you know, one council member on it, in all likelihood the chairman of the education committee. But the mayor has made it very clear that all the council members are sort of welcome to participate, because he needs our support, our buy-in for whatever initiatives they come up with. And there'll be, you know, 10 other members that he'll be announcing tomorrow as part of the team. There was a lot of people wanted to be part of this education redesign team because they recognize that there are problems and we need to come up with solutions. And I think short term, they want to come up with some solutions that will impact this budget in 2 months. Long term, some of their projects may take a while, but it's good to start the thoughtful process of engagement.
I wanted to ask you also about another thing that you mentioned, and that is the decay of a lot of the properties from the 1900s that were built and evidently are still withstanding the elements. And that's another thing, too. What about the attitude of opening up these buildings to the elements, trying to promote their decay in order to be able to run down the value of these properties so that they can be literally picked up for a song? And that's the problem, too, isn't it, with part of our economic development buildup, where property is either taken away through eminent domain or is just literally turned into blight and then turned over to developers for a dollar. So we lose a tremendous amount of value in that process, yet it seems to be a process that works, but evidently it's not working here. And the question then always becomes, is that also part of the purview of the city council to demand better contracts that come out of corporation council? Can we trust that these things are done right by the people?
Well, you know, there are a number of buildings that come to mind, and whether it be the Boyce Thompson Institute building, the Longfellow School, School 19,
yeah,
the Glenwood Power Plant, you know, some of these buildings are still ready and able to be adaptively reused. And others, like School 6, have fallen into such disrepair that, you know, unfortunately, they will have to be torn down. Although just last night I was talking to the community builders group, which are doing the housing around Cottage Place, and they committed to keeping the arch from the very iconic arch from School 6 and taking down the stones stone by stone, and when they rebuild their building, that will be a big part of its facade, and the architecture will revolve around the old arch. So, you know, hopefully in that case it will be preserved. But, you know, when you think about it, when you go back to see where you grew up, your hometown, my parents are in their 80s or about to turn 80, and recently visited, you know, their hometown. And, you know, my dad went to where his school once, and he saw a shopping mall. I mean, you know, you lose all your connection. If you go back and you see the old buildings, you have the old memories. And that's why it's so important to save some of these buildings. Also, you know, from a value point of view, we had a tremendous success story and a tremendous failure in Northwest Yonkers, very close to each other. When the old Smith Collins building was torn down in the middle of the night on a weekend, when the city couldn't do anything about it, and frankly the city had issued a demo permit and knew damn well what was going to happen, but maybe the community couldn't do anything about it, there was uproar when 575 North Broadway was posed as a teardown. And, you know, the developer that was going to come in was going to tear it down and replace it with five McMansions. The community was concerned. We found out about it quickly and were able to rally around, landmark that building. And the couple that bought it have painstakingly restored that building with much detail, and it really improves the neighborhood right now. Mm-hmm. It's a great building. They paid almost as much as the developer who was going to do the tear down. Not as much. There was a little diminution in value, I'll admit that. But then again, it was the public administrator who was handling the estate of a deceased woman who died without heirs. So, you know, who really was going to get that money anyway? Well, it was ultimately going to be the state of New York. So, you know, the fact that they got a few thousand dollars less on a deal that was, you know, more than $1 million, doesn't really distress me, because the community wound up with a much better resource, and the value of the homes around that historic building that's been preserved is greater because of what was built there. So, you know, again, looking for the appropriate balance. We can't save every old building in Yonkers. We don't want to save every old building in Yonkers. Some of them rightly deserve to fall down or be you know, the land reused for something else. But those that had an important part in history, those that were designed by a significant architect, those that something significant happened in the building, these are the sorts of buildings that we hope to save.
What are we doing about some of the other problems that we have, like on the waterfront with the development? The Collins Building is still in bankruptcy. The Capelli people are literally bankrupt, and yet they're holding a master development designation. Is that going to allow us to move ahead, or are we stymied by the reality of these people and their businesses not being viable? I mean, how do we get around all of this, or do we have to wait another 4 or 5 years before we can do anything? And that's the big question.
The Collins buildings, you know, again, we can criticize them for not being architecturally interesting enough, for not having enough terraces and things like that. But they were built, you know, to a certain budget that was available at the time, and with some brownfield cleanup funds, because they needed to do that. They were an important part of jump-starting the waterfront. If not for the Collins buildings, you wouldn't have X2O, you wouldn't have the Dolphin, you wouldn't have, you know, some of that activity that goes on the waterfront. You know, what percentage of the buildings are occupied at any one time? You know, I see lots of people coming and going from the train station. They pay their taxes, the Collins building. So, I do know that there was a reorganization. One of the buildings at one point, some of the people moved from one to another. Mm-hmm. That's really up to them and their business model. As far as SFC is concerned, they have a tremendous asset. They spent over $1 million in plans and sending lawyers to meetings and the approval process, and they have approvals from the city council. And I think we did a good job of making sure the city got as much tax revenue as possible, that we weren't giving away any property for a dollar, and that we, in that case, are going to get a good return. And it was negotiated with a strong developer on the other side. May not be as strong now. So at some point, one of the three. I think the F, the Fidelco of SFC, is probably the strongest of the three financially, and whether he, you know, brings Capelli along, Capelli brings a lot to the project, or whether Capelli sells his interest to somebody else, you know, that's a personal decision that they have to make at a certain point in time. We did put in deadlines into the approval process, and we also gave the developer the ability to buy extended time, so if he does get a little bit of extended time, that's again at a value to the city. I believe that all that work was not to naught, and that at some point either this developer will regroup or will sell his interest to somebody else who will step into his shoes and build.
That's the other thing, though, too. What about the money that we gave them, that signature loan? Were you involved in being aware of that, for example? We gave them $4 million on the signature for Delco and Capelli, and we used H&I as collateral, which they did not own. So that was done illegally by the former administration. I don't think it was done by the city council. But the question is, like, when are we going to get paid all this money? And how do we scrutinize all of this? Is that also the purview of the city council?
The loan that you're referring to, I believe, was a Section 108 loan.
Yep.
And for whatever quirky reasons, the city council president does not sit on that. The
right.
council majority and minority leader do, and neither of those people are still on the council. Again, at the time with the 108 loan, I don't recall whether the council had ultimately approved it or not, but it was something that we should have approved because it was money that had been repaid from a previous 108 user, and it was money the city couldn't return to HUD because of the terms of the agreement. So they basically needed to relend it to somebody, and they have relent it to somebody, and that was SFC. And
didn't pay back. See, that's the problem. Yeah. They didn't pay us back, and we paid HUD back. So
right.
we lost it twice.
Our obligation to HUD was whether or not we lent the money to SFC or not. SFC's obligation to the city remains, and hopefully, if there are financial issues with the current SFC entity, whoever takes over those interests will have this obligation as well to repay. Mm-hmm. So it may wind up that the city winds up floating that money for some period of time. But again, they float it with interest, and hopefully that interest is better than interest that they would earn on, in the bank if they had it. Again, I wasn't privy to the underwriting details of that because I wasn't on the 108 review committee, but I was certainly privy to the concept and supportive of the notion that this was helping the city with its 108 repayment issues and helping the project at a certain point in time when they needed help. And I'm still pretty confident that some entity will repay that.
So, when the public looks at all these issues that come up and it's costing the city money, which means it costs the taxpayer money, and should people look at the city council to remedy some of these concerns? We always had a strong mayor form of government. The last two administrations, which equated to 16 years of whatever they did, the bottom line is it wasn't always to the benefit of the public good, and it didn't always work out. Certainly it didn't work out where coffers stayed balanced, and we kept losing and losing money year after year after year. Should the public look at the city council to be able to scrutinize, to mitigate these things from happening into the future? I mean, we can kick the can down the road forever, but we're having financial difficulty. Can we afford to do that?
Right. We're having financial difficulty, as is just about every city and state in this country having financial difficulty.
But that doesn't matter, does it? Does it matter if the guy next door to us is doing very well and we're in the gutter, or that they're doing badly and we're doing badly?
Well, yeah, it does matter, because I think that we have to look at some of the reasons why we're in the situation that we do, that we have. You know, and if you look at the national economy and what happened in the 2000s when, you know, we went from having a surplus when Clinton left office to having two wars, that we had to finance in Iraq and Afghanistan, and having a national debt that went, you know, $8 trillion. You know, some of the things that President Obama did to take us out of that have worked, like the GM deal. I mean, GM is still standing. GM, they're making cars. People were writing off the whole auto industry. But because the government stepped in and bailed out the companies, those loans have been paid back. Even the banking, the TARP that the president was involved in, worked from a financial point of view, in that most of the banks have already paid back the money they got. The problem with the bank money is that there weren't enough incentives and oversight put in to make the banks actually lend the money to the people and help the poor people who had houses underwater refinance their mortgage. And that's what, you know, Attorney General Schneiderman is going to be looking at, trying to compel some of these banks to go forward and make the loans that they did. The other thing is, you know, there's always envy in this world where you do look over and see how the other guy is doing. And when some of these Wall Street executives got bonuses for what was essentially bad behavior, driving their companies into the ground, there was a lot of anger, and that really led to this whole Occupy Wall Street movement, the unfairness of it all. And I believe that conversation has changed nationally, and that some of our tax policies are being better addressed to address some of the inequality. Even in New York State, you know, Governor Cuomo extended the millionaires tax for the true millionaires, yet was able to deliver middle-class tax cuts and increased revenue, and that helped the budget deficit. So, you know, well, it's related.
No, I understand that it's related. I just wonder, like, where will the people go to expect some sort of remedy from all these issues? Do we expect at least a transparent discussion of these things in government itself? What should we look for? This administration is very young. You know, we're going to in a week's time we're going to have the State of the City address. So that's really quite exciting. It certainly comes at a propitious time, and I just wonder, like, where we are heading. Maybe I'm a little bit anxious because I've certainly lived through enough that was not very good, and so I'm hoping for good stuff. I'm very positive too. I just wonder if there are mechanisms that the city council can formulate in order to be able to conduct their business for the city as opposed to strictly for the mayor, which has been the routine in the past.
Right. I mean, again, openness and transparency is the best. What did Brandeis say? The sunlight is the best disinfectant in a democracy.
Yes.
Like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, so if you shine the light on transactions and on deliberations, then that's the best way to do it. Obviously, when you're talking about real estate deals and the assets of private developers, there are issues of confidentiality, which you have to respect. But so long as the public is aware of the tenor of the discussion and the goals and the objectives of this of the city, and when I say city, I include the mayor and the city council because we're partners, then I think you'll get a good product and one that will withstand scrutiny.
Absolutely. We're coming basically to the end of the hour, and I was wondering if you had anything in particular that you wanted to express today, because we will be doing this on a regular basis, but is there something that's important right now that people need to hear about?
Well, one of the issues that's being debated, and probably in the next month before I speak again, is on redistricting. And, it's very important in a democracy to have competitive districts. And it's very unfortunate when the people that are in office draw the lines to their own advantage just to keep themselves in office. And if you look at New York State, you know, one state happens for a Democratic state right now with a Democratic governor, yet we managed to have a Democratic assembly and a Republican Senate because the Republican senators draw their lines and the Democratic assemblymen draw their lines. And, you know, we see what just happened here in Westchester County, where the Republicans in the Senate, in an effort to recapture the seat of the retiring Susie Oppenheimer, have put half of Yonkers, most of the Republican side, the east side of Yonkers, in a district that sort of goes through East Chester and then comes down and grabs a piece of New Rochelle and then goes up the Sound Shore, a district that was clearly drawn for Bob Cohn, who was likely to be challenged by George Latimer. And up a little bit further on the Hudson, they took Ossining out of Westchester and put it in with Rockland County and Dave Carlucci's district, giving him more Democrats. Again, I've seen districts cross the river, like Elliot Engel and Nita Lowy. One has the northbound side of the Tappan Zee, one has the southbound side. But in Ossining, they didn't even bother with a bridge. They just, you know, they just put Ossining on the other side. Andrea Stewart-Cousins' district was packed with Democrats. You know, after they kept it competitive for her predecessor, Nick Spano, it wasn't competitive enough. Obviously, he lost that position because they put too many in what was the old Guy Vilela seat, to too many Republicans there. So, you know, now they're sort of conceding, okay, Andrea's going to be there for a while, so let's give her a bunch of Democrats and take the Republicans out of her seat and put them in the Cohn seat. What troubles me is that Yonkers has always had a senator who has argued for increased education aid when the formula doesn't work in Yonkers. And whether it was Senator Stewart-Cousins, Senator Spano, Senator Flynn before her, we've always had a strong senator from Yonkers that could help correct the problems. And right now, Andrea is not, Yonkers is not the majority of Senator Stewart-Cousins' district. Scarsdale and Greenberg make up more of the district than Yonkers does. So that after Senator Stewart-Cousins is finished serving her terms, whatever that is, one, two, three, four, five more terms, the next senator may not be from Yonkers. And may not advocate for our children. So that's what concerns me. That's why I testified before Latford, the legislative redistricting. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a presentation at the Will Library at the beginning of March. It's Monday night. I think it's the 5th. I want to say the 5th. On gerrymandering. We're going to show a film called Gerrymandering that talks about the problem. We're going to have a panel discussion with someone from Common Cause, and then invite one of the Democrats and Republicans involved in the process to come in, and it'll be a very timely discussion because they really need to get their decisions made quickly. You know, believe it or not, Shelley Mayer is running for the assembly seat held by Mike Spano in a special election on March 20th. I think petition process will start March 20th for the next election. Because we used to have our primaries in September, but because of various court orders, they're going to be in June now, June 26th, I think. So to do that, to get the candidates on the ballot, there's a whole new schedule that has to be followed, which includes March petitions. So she'll not even be elected to the assembly seat, and she'll have to turn around and start getting signatures for her next run, which is very compressed period of time. So that's an issue that we should be looking at.
Well, there's a lot on the plate, so I can only wish you well, and can't wait to hear from you again so we can discuss some other concerns and other issues.
And by the way, speaking about that special election, even though Shelley Mayer doesn't have any active opponent, I mean, there's a Republican ballot, Donna Nolan, who's announced that she's not running, it is very important for people to just show up and vote in the election. And
why? Why is that? Why is that important? That's what I don't understand.
Number one, it shows interest. It shows interest from what parts of town people come from. You know, too often you hear on the city council, well, people in those parts of the community don't show up and vote, so I'm not going to care about them. I'm not going to care about education because the parents of the school kids don't vote enough. I mean, those sorts of get said a lot. So it is important. Number two is you know, it is always possible that if nobody shows up to vote, a small minority of people will and can control election and can actually change the outcome of an election. And, you know, I've been the beneficiary and the victim of being on the short end and the long end of some very close races, one of which I won by 28 votes. A primary against Zimmer Brandt in 2003. I had my race with Castro Blanco where I was down by 250 votes on election night and won by 139 votes. We, of course, know Andrea Stewart Cousins' story about losing, theoretically, to Nick Spano in 2004 by 18 votes. Mm-hmm. We had a mayor in Irvington who finished in a dead heat tie, Erin Malloy. And it was because a woman who had voted with her married name should have used her maiden name because that's how she was registered, and they didn't count that vote, and they had to flip a coin, and she wound up losing. She won 2 years later. So, I mean, there are a lot of close races that are a result of lower turnout. And, you know, you see these super PACs on the national level spending all this negative money, and, you know, negative advertising is proven to take down the popularity of your opponent, but what negative advertising has done over the last 20, 30 years has diminished the voting turnout in this country to a point that it's embarrassing. You know, when Eisenhower ran against Adlai Stevenson, you know, well over 80% of the people in this country voted. We didn't see those sorts of numbers until the Obama race last time. Certainly the Kerry-Bush race was very low turnout race, and, you know, you get problems when people don't turn out and vote. So, you know, we look across the world and we see emerging democracies where people are risking their lives to vote in elections. And, you know, in Iraq, and they had to put their fingers in the ink, and they had to go through militias, and in South America, in South Africa, when African-Americans, well, I'm sorry, when blacks first were given the opportunity to vote, these were all, you know, experiments with democracy. Here we've had democracy for over 200 years, the oldest democracy in the world, and the people don't utilize it. They don't vote. So as Ben Franklin said to a woman who asked him what he had done in the Continental Congress, he said, "We created a republic. Now it's up to you to decide whether you can keep it."
That's really very good. Well, I really very much appreciate your time, Mr. Lesnick, City Council President of Yonkers. I guess that's it. If you have more time, we certainly can entertain you. I don't have anyone else scheduled, but that's up to you because I don't want to encroach on your time or your schedule.
And I don't want a filibuster beyond my hour, but otherwise you won't invite me back next time.
No, I will. I will. That has nothing to do with it. It's just up to you. It's up to you because there are just so many concerns. But, you know, we can always salivate for the next time you're on.
Right, I have to keep them wanting a little bit more,
and I
do have to go over to City Hall and take care of some business.
Very
so,
good.
So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your public, and appreciate the new medium that you're using to get the word out. Because again, we can only shine the light so much without a free press that amplifies that light. So I appreciate the press, even when I don't agree with them all the time.
Well, that's okay. And we've been in disagreement at times, but that doesn't change the fact that, you know, I think we all need each other, and it's better that we keep talking.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again. Enjoy the week. And thank you again, Chuck Lesnick, Yonkers City Council President.
Thank you, Hezzy.
Have a good day. Well, there you have it, folks. That was Chuck Lesnick, the Yonkers City Council person. He's got two more years left in his tenure, and it should be very interesting to see how he moves ahead and how the Yonkers City Council moves ahead in conjunction with, and that's the hope, in conjunction with the new mayor of the city of Yonkers, in this case, Mike Spano, or on a separate track. One never knows. But right now it does seem that they're more interested in working together and finding a path that will be just accommodating of all factions or as many factions as possible on the city council as well as on the executive branch, and so that the city ends up garnering a great deal of support into as they march into the future. So that's really, really cool stuff. Let's look at something else that's going on today. I'm going to do a quick transition while we're at it. In case you want to get involved in the discussion, you're certainly welcome to do so. And you may do so by giving us a call toll-free at 877-674-2436. So this is Westchester on the Level. This is the Westchester Guardian Radio Network. It all falls under the aegis of the Hezitorial of Absurdity. And my name is Hezi Aris, your host. And we'll play a quick commercial for the Westchester Broadway Theater's upcoming programming. So hold on a moment there.
Yes, the Irish eyes will be smiling at the Westchester Broadway Theater on Tuesday, March 6th as they welcome back Ireland's own Noel V. Ginnity, starring in Taylor's traditional Irish cabaret for a matinee and evening performance. Noel Ginnity is Ireland's greatest comedian, and he comes to the WBT direct from Dublin, along with the unforgettable Irish soprano Emer Harnett, and from the original Irish tenors, the amazing Paul Hennessy. And with traditional ballad singer Andrew McCarthy, renowned Elian Piper Tommy Keane, and Dublin's traditional Irish dancers, they'll provide magical Irish memories you'll cherish long after the lights have gone down. And remember, at the WBT, it's always more than just a show, it's an event. So you'll also enjoy a delicious served dinner before the show with favorites like corned beef and cabbage, lamb stew, and Irish soda bread. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Come get your Irish up this year with Taylor's traditional Irish cabaret starring Noel V. Ginnity. Tuesday, March the 6th with matinee and evening performances only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level, and let's discuss some of the issues that have come to play over the last few days. One of the most important, which is going to cast a shadow, a strong, very, very dark shadow, is the case that is in the midst of, that has just started, literally this past Tuesday, were the beginning testimonies that came out of the court case that is the government versus the Sandy Anabi, a former Yonkers City Council majority leader, as well as against Zahi Jaris, who was the former GOP chairman, also in the city of Yonkers. And what transpired yesterday was we had written about everything that had taken place there, except our sources were not there at the time that that John Murtaugh was testifying. He was evidently called. He was the most recent minority leader on the Yonkers City Council. He just departed the his work on the Yonkers City Council this past year in 2011. That was when he was term limited. But the thing that was interesting that came about yesterday was in the testimony, a jeweler from a New Rochelle jewelry store testified that Zahi Jaris came to his store with Sandy Anabi, and that he had suggested to the jewelry owner that the jeweler take care of Sandy Anabi with her desires of jewelry. And evidently, that particular day, she ended up purchasing a Rolex watch with a diamond necklace so there was a lot of money spent there, and this was supposedly all happening while prosecutors contend that about $20,000 worth in bribe money was received by Anabi herself. Meantime, it also came about that in the testimony, Zahi Jaris claimed to have showered Ms. Anabi with expensive favors because he was interested in her for amorous reasons. And that's the contention. And there was also testimony that a Mercedes-Benz was leased and for the benefit and for the use of Sandy Nabi. There were also contention that he upgraded her airline ticket to business class on an international flight, and so on and so forth. So it was really quite interesting. And then in the Journal News today, it was reported that Murtaugh had claimed to have been approached as well by Forest City Ratner for all sorts of issues, and they wanted his votes, and they wanted him to work out with them and work out a deal, but he was not going to be part and parcel. He was against the actual development for a lot of reasons, and he didn't want to go with it. But at the end, when Sandy Nabi did vote for the project, there were enough votes for the project to move ahead. And so there we basically have it, and that's where it stands. There are still a lot of witnesses that are being called by the government, so we still haven't heard the other side of the equation. And if there is a reasonable, rationale for the behavior of both Mr. Jarris as well as Ms. Nabi, sometimes it is circumstantial, but we're not sure yet. The government has certainly spent a tremendous amount of time, and many, many potential witnesses can be called. We'll see if they are being called. So it becomes very, very interesting and very pertinent to the conduct, I guess, of the city into the future as to how we're seen, how we're viewed, and where this thing is going. You know, there's also a tremendous amount of talk, you know, the chatter that goes on the different websites and comments and stuff like that. Let's see, there was actually one comment in the Journal News. So let's see what someone said here. No, it's only a request, a comment. Oh, no, there is a comment. Somebody by the name of John O'Reilly. And John O'Reilly writes on the Journal News comment to their recent story from what transpired in the courthouse yesterday. He says, "Nice move by Sandy to wear the expensive Rolex and gold necklace to the September 2006 council meeting, where she switched her vote on the Longfellow deal." That's the Longfellow school deal. "Some may not recall at the meeting, Sandy started singing, 'Look at me now, look at me now, I'm getting paper, look at me now, yeah, yeah, I'm getting paper.' I don't quite understand what that means, 'I'm getting paper.' So that went over my head, and so we'll see what goes on. And let's see. Last I looked, there really was no comment whatsoever on the Yonkers Tribune site. If there was anything, the reporting is similar to the Journal News, except it did not have the testimony or the gist of the testimony of Mr. Murtaugh. At least not on the Yonkers Tribune site. We didn't have an insider looking into it or revealing it at that time. Okay, there seem to be two comments that have been posted since this early morning. Let's see what it says here. The first one, and we permit anonymous comment, the first one says, "If it ends up being true that Jarris was infatuated with Nabi, I really can't understand that one. Sandy Nabi is one ugly-looking lady. Yuck." Well, you know, that sort of commentary is really quite unnecessary. It's truly a shame because it doesn't. We don't necessarily have to demonize her, even if she were guilty. It's unnecessary, but so it is. You know, we have to accept and deal with the reality of the environment we live in. And some people would just like to kick people while they're down. They may be standing at the end of this. You just never know. So personally, I don't want to judge one way or the other. Okay, let's see what else is happening. The next one says, what a coincidence. Jairus starts to shower Navi with expensive gifts just about the time that the vote for Ridgehill, a project that his bosses are lobbying for through the Patricia Lynch firm, is due. Check the phone records. He had a girlfriend and a wife at the time. Well, we'll see. You know, this is the thing that really is unnerving. You know, there's nothing wrong with a comment. You know, it is what it is. But, you know, if these issues are correct, you know, and if he did have a girlfriend, we know he had a wife, and she's still with him, and it must be a tragedy to go through this at the moment. But whatever the case is, if there was another girlfriend at the time, and it is pertinent that that was the case, then it should be revealed, and I guess it will be. Certainly, one would expect the government to have done its due diligence, and I'm sure they have. And if this leads them into a direction, that's fine. I guess one of the problems with all the cases, whether it's Mr. Jairus, whether it's Ms. Anabi, or other situations, is that, you know, people are people, and some of the actions people take is embarrassing, and one can't even request transparency on issues because they're so embarrassing. Even though so few people care one way or the other with regard to what's going on in the scene, what's fascinating is that there's no place to go, there's no place to share this information where it can be trusted to be utilized in a way that will benefit the public good, and that to me is the biggest tragedy of all, because it shows that the mechanisms that we believe in are not always there. And they're almost meant to close our eyes to the reality of their ineffectiveness or their lack of concern one way or the other, because there are too many loopholes by which those that may conceivably inadvertently conduct something that is not of value to a city or a community, or that may do so because that's what they choose to do, which still is not valid for a community or a city, can get away with it. And that there is no mechanism one can trust or one that believes that they can trust. So the perception is that there are no options for many people to go to. They don't believe in the IG. They don't believe in the AG. They don't believe in the New York State Attorney General's office or the you know, the district attorney, or, you know, there are just so many places that we have lost our ability to be comforted by the mechanisms that we have put in place. And evidently, they're just not working, so we really must consider a way to give them credibility, infuse them with a sense of credibility, explain why they do work. And maybe it is a question of, you know, it's almost like a marriage. It is really a marriage where, you know, like some people say, oh, well, this is ridiculous. After 20 years of marriage, they're going to restate their vows. They're going to go through this process again, and they're going to just restate their vows and their love for one another. And hey, maybe it seemed ridiculous when I first heard about it, but then I was so much younger, and what did I know? At this point, you know, maybe it is important for government to make that pledge, to live up to the pledge, to to have a platform in which they can't say, hey, I know that you didn't believe, but knowing that you didn't believe, knowing that you fell out of love to some extent, but there throbbing heart that is there, that pulsates for the city and for the benefit of the community overall, is still there, and I'm going to keep it alive, and I keep it alive for you as the leader of the city, as the membership of the city council, as the people who work for the city, and this is what we do, and we do it because we understand that, you know, we're doing it for the better of the city, and this is how we do it, and this is how we actually maintain your trust. That maybe that's the biggest challenge of all, and that we need to be able to find the avenue in which we can move forward on that plane. We've got to build those bridges, folks, and hopefully that's what we are doing. Certainly, I think circumstances have clouded the direction at the moment. It came at a time that is very difficult for the city. It probably would have been better had we had a year or two under the new administration's belt in order to be able to start to tackle this issue. I'm not saying it should have been held off. It could have started earlier. I don't know why it started now. But it doesn't matter. I guess no time is a good time for bad news. The question is, will it incapacitate this new administration? And again, that's not the responsibility of anybody on the government side of the equation. They didn't create this. They did not create this mess. So it's an investigation. Everyone should be considered innocent until proven guilty. I certainly will maintain that aspect about it. Don't have a particular need to look at it that way, other than the fact that the judicial system says or asks of me to keep an open mind, and I do, and I will, and I would hope that everyone else does as well, and judges the situation that will unfold before our very eyes through the different mediums that or media that go down there and cover the event. And the bottom line is that if that is the case, that we should be able to move ahead and just see where things are at. But to keep the personalities out of it, just judging it on the facts, and we'll see if things went awry. And so something a little bit unnerving as well, though, with regard to the testimony of John Murtaugh. Certainly he did not care for the personality, Mr. Jarrus, which is interesting because it was Jarrus as the GOP chairman that moved John Murtaugh ahead in the process. But that doesn't mean anything, you know. I think the thing that really concerns me is Mr. Murtaugh and his knowing of the attempted bribery of not only him but of others, and he makes it seem as though this was a given. And how was he to know? And that was very interesting. And why it wasn't made public is beyond me as well. And again, maybe even people like the Yonkers City Councilman, when approached, found that there was no mechanism through which he can bring this forward. Frightening stuff that here an elected official felt muzzled. But he was the one that felt muzzled. It was nobody else that muzzled him. He could have certainly brought out the issue in a Yonkers City Council meeting and said, I'm sorry, but this just won't wash. And I was approached, and he didn't even have to name names. Not that it would have mattered, But the bottom line is you should have said that he was approached. And rather than to wait for someone else to claim that they had won the day. But he was silent when the funds were said to have come into the city, when Forest City Ratner basically said, hey, they worked out a deal with Sandy and Nobby, supposedly, where we were going to get an extra $10 million. Whatever did happen to that extra $10 million that she was able to get? Where did it go? You know, that's a big question. Where did the money go? $10 million. Did it go into the pockets of the city coffers? How did we spend it? Did we spend it? Is it still in an escrow account? You know, did it go to Mr. Phil Amaconi and his friends? Where did it go? That's what I'd like to know. I hope that in this case we get to know exactly where the money went, rather than just to conjecture one way or the other. Well, I see that we're approximately halfway into the hour, so let's go back to the Westchester Broadway Theater and take a listen to Swonderful.
Wonderful.
One of the most unique shows ever is coming to the Westchester Broadway Theater on March 1st. Their exciting production of the new Gershwin musical, Swonderful. The singing and dancing sensation that follows five separate storylines through five memorable eras. New York in the 20s, Paris in the 30s, Hollywood in the 40s, New Orleans in the 50s, and right up to today. And it features over 40 of the all-time Gershwin classics like Someone to Watch Over Me, I've Got a Crush on You, I Got Rhythm, They Can't Take That Away from Me, and of course, Swonderful. As part of the WBT's 2012 season with More Musicals More Often, Swonderful is playing for 4 weeks only, so you'll want to make your reservations early. And don't forget, before the show, you'll enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of six entrees and all for one low price. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Don't miss the singing and dancing sensation that is Swonderful, the new Gershwin musical. March 1st through March 25th only, and only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, we are back. And I guess I'm looking through really quite quickly through the emails to see if anything of great importance has come in on the wires in order to advise you and to keep you up to date. I'm just going through this very quickly. And all right, let's just see a little bit further. Doesn't look like there is much at the moment. Well, certainly what's going on in the world scene is going to affect us. And particularly gasoline prices. The frightening thing is, will it actually at the end of the day cause our economy that's really coming up from the floor? Will it cause us to flounder economically? So it's not something that we would look at. would come to pass. So let's see what else is here. Okay, let's just see what else is happening. Okay, I just don't see anything. Wait, here's a notice. Okay, well that's all right. I just did get a notice. That I don't have to attend a particular lunch meeting, so that helps a great deal. All right. Wait, there is something going on here. Well, this is quite interesting. This came from Senator Jeffrey Klein's office. He's a Democrat representing the Bronx and parts of Westchester. He's the chairman of the New York State Senate Standing Committee on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. And on the four loco-related death of a 13-year-old Maryland teen, the senator says this tragic death, which media reports state came after the team consumed Four Loko. That's F-O-U-R-L-O-K-O. It's a drink. It's a reminder of how dangerous this product is, especially in its original caffeinated form. While its maker said they would not sell Four Loko's original formula in New York State, I remain concerned by reports that some stores have apparently ignored what is essentially a gentleman's agreement. My legislation, that in the Senate, that is listed as S-3889A, to outright ban these types of high alcohol, highly caffeinated Alco-Pops, has already passed out of the Senate Committee on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, which I chair, and is ready for a vote by the full Senate body. It's my hope that this legislation becomes law, and that similar tragedies can be avoided in New York once and for all. So, very, very important issue that's come to light. And this was really quite interesting today. It turns out that, as we spoke about before, Shelley Mayer is running for assembly, and she's earned the endorsement from fire and police unions. So it seems that she received the endorsement of the police and fire unions of Yonkers, the Yonkers Fire Local 628, the Yonkers Uniformed Fire Officers Association, the Yonkers Police Captains, Lieutenants, and Sergeants Association, and the Yonkers Police Benevolent Association. So that took place today. So evidently she's earned their support. So that's very, very interesting. And I guess good luck to Ms. Mayer for that. And that's it. On another important issue, it turns out there were two reporters, actually one a photojournalist that is French, and another American reporter working for over two decades for the Sunday Times of London. They were killed in the onslaught against the city of Homs in Syria. So that's a very, very big tragedy that's come to the forefront, and not a good thing. Let's just quickly look as well to see what's going on in the stock market, and we'll see if anything has transpired. Looks like the market's down slightly. 12,952 is the Dow, which is down 13.55 points. That's down less than 0.1%. NASDAQ's also down to 29.41. That's down about 8 points, which translates to being about one quarter of 1% down. And the Standard & Poor's is also down to about 13.60. That's down close to 3 points, and that's down about 9.19%. So I guess people are not so sure how to take what's going on the Greek bailout, or the promise of the Greek bailout, and we'll see how that transpires. Oh, there is one thing here I missed for a moment. Okay, this is not pertinent. I thought it was something there, but no. So I guess that's where we stand on the markets. There's a lot of uncertainty there. There seems to be a lot of uncertainty with regard to what's going on in the courtroom at the moment, with regard to the Zahi Jaris, Sandy Anabi case. Who knows what Anthony Mangone, who's regarded as the tell-all man to the federal government. So it would be interesting to see what he has to say. He might be called. Certainly the new mayor of the city of Yonkers could be called, the former senator, the one who pleaded guilty to tax evasion, the Emilio brothers and father, the part of the Emilio management team, they too also admitted to tax evasion. and we'll just see where all of this stuff goes. Not quite sure where it's going to lead, and just be very interesting. It's also interesting, you know, what Chuck Lesnik had said from the Yonkers City Council president, as the lines are drawn for political office, the so-called gerrymandering, where, you know, certain districts will be redrawn for the benefit of one party as opposed to another. And these things constantly switch every 10 years, as is required. Well, the census is required every 10 years, and it causes, it's the catalyst for the redrawing of the districts. But what's interesting is that while Yonkers has always presented itself as being unfairly recognized for its own issues within an extremely well-to-do community, and thereby we postulate as a city, I don't know if it's right or wrong, if you really must know, but we postulated for the city that we don't get our fair share of funding. And if we should lose a senator that would represent us, that would be quite tragic, and we would have no one to speak for the city. And what's mind-blowing about it is that here we are, the fourth largest city in the state, with very little or a dissipated representation. And it just doesn't speak well. It seems as if the gerrymandering process might actually eviscerate the power of the city, because we won't have enough of the city represented by a concerted voice that would benefit the city itself. So it would be a shame to Senator Klein, whose influence will be gerrymandered away from the district. As Chuck Lesnik pointed out, Andrea Stewart-Cousins has got greater sway over Greenberg and other parts of the county than she does over Yonkers. So the question is, well, who will represent the city? And so this is going to be basically an interesting exercise to see where we end up. And I wonder why we've never seen or heard. It's possible we've just not heard of it, even though it may have taken place, but we don't see a concerted voice coming out of Yonkers as well as Mount Vernon in conjunction. Can you imagine the fourth largest city in the state in conjunction with the sixth largest city in the state? Altogether, that would make quite a formidable expression of thought, because both cities claim or profess to have been unfairly represented in the equation, if you want to call it that, in the formula, if you want to call it that, with regard to school funding. And both claim that they are not fairly treated in the funding formula. So very interesting to see where this is going to go. And the fact that both boards of education from both cities have not formulated a concerted voice and focus on the issue is a little bit troubling. Because it shouldn't be a specifically Republican or Democrat type of issue. But maybe that was the cause of the divide. You know, here Mount Vernon is a Democratic city, overwhelmingly so. And the city of Yonkers hung on to its Republican roots. And maybe the schism between the past administrations, Spencer and Amicone and Yonkers, over 16 years, and the 12 years with Ernest Davis and then Clinton Young, didn't bode well. But now we have Ernie Davis back, Democratic mayor, and then Mike Spano, Democratic mayor. It's conceivable that the two cities could actually work together in conjunction with over dual concerns, lack of getting a fair shake in education, and we'll see if they could do anything about it, if it matters. I always wonder if we've outplayed the game for so long that we've hurt ourselves in the process, and that too can be unnerving. So let's quickly look to see if anything else has transpired. Absolutely not. So that's cool. Let me go over to Low Hut to see if anything else has happened there that we haven't touched upon today. And as we approach the last 20 minutes or so of the show, in the meantime, while I'm talking to you, let me turn over the calendar. Oh, this is going to be really quite good. It seems that Stephen Serrato, who ran for office for city council, he's going to be our guest tomorrow. From 10 to 11, I look forward to speaking to him. It should be a lot of fun just getting his perspective. He does not sit on the Yonkers Council. However, he has a good sense of what's going on in the city. It'll be interesting to see an unfettered perspective from a very, very well-spoken young man who has a love for the city as well, and it's just good to see and good to talk to him. Let's see. It turns out today is Wednesday, and I should remember to advise everyone that Lent begins with Ash Wednesday observances today. Timothy Cardinal Dolan is back home, so that's always exciting. Today is also the birthday of our co-host Richard Narog's wife, Bernadette Narog. So happy birthday and many, many healthy more years of joy and accomplishment to you, Bernadette. So it's really cool. And then guess what? Tomorrow is going to be Narog's birthday. He's going to outdo his wife by gathering one more, you know, year under his belt, so I guess he'll be a year older. Today they're the same age, but we won't ask how old, so because we don't want to have any inferences anywhere about how old the good looking wife is. That's important. And there's going to be a change. Debate by the New Rochelle City Council, who voted on Tuesday to spend $6 million to design a maintenance facility for the Department of Public Works. That's going to be interesting. I'm sure Peggy Free will write to that effect in the upcoming edition of the Westchester Guardian. So let's see what else is happening here. Okay, I don't think anything else is happening here that I recognize of great importance news-wise, so I guess that's about it. All right, well, the thing that really blows my mind, there was an article with regard to a Rye citizen. Evidently, he was caught molested a tenant's Labrador retriever sexually. I don't know. I can't even imagine, this whole concept of bestiality, but that's not even going to be another show. I just can't. I don't know what to tell you. I'm just like not there at all. I don't even find that in any form kinky. Okay, so covered a lot of ground here, and I see we're just about at the quarter hour, so we're going to tell you what else is happening at the Westchester Broadway Theater, and this one has an Irish string to it.
Yes, the Irish eyes will be smiling at the Westchester Broadway Theater on Tuesday, March 6th as they welcome back Ireland's own Noel V. Ginnity, starring in Taylor's Traditional Irish Cabaret for a matinee and evening performance. Noel Ginnity is Ireland's greatest comedian, and he comes to the WBT direct from Dublin, along with the unforgettable Irish soprano Emer Harnett, and from the original Irish tenors, the amazing Paul Hennessy. And with traditional ballad singer Andrew McCarthy, renowned Elian Piper Tommy Keane, and Dublin's traditional Irish dancers, they'll provide magical Irish memories you'll cherish long after the lights have gone down. And remember, at the WBT, it's always more than just a show, it's an event. So you'll also enjoy a delicious served dinner before the show with favorites like corned beef and cabbage, lamb stew, and Irish soda bread. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Come get your Irish up this year with Taylor's Traditional Irish Cabaret starring Noel V. Ginnity. Tuesday, March the 6th with matinee and evening performances only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
We are back the last 15 minutes of the show. One of the things that also is a bit unnerving is that there will be the contest in Michigan that's coming, and Rick Santorum evidently seems to be in a poll, a leading Mitt Romney by 16 points. Somehow the so-called front runner has lost his. He must not be delivering something that resonates credibly with the base. Other people conjecture that it's the mainstream media, the so-called liberal media that has promoted Mitt Romney because they thought he was the weakest of all the candidates. They felt that Santorum was too far in the extreme. They felt Gingrich was the most powerful from a speaking perspective, intelligent, yet his baggage would be his ruin, or actually would be his ruin because the main so-called liberal media was against him. Found him to be very, very strong, a bit too powerful, in ability to respond cerebrally and forcefully with assertiveness, and so just very, very interesting. That's not to detract in any way, shape, or form Santorum's ability to just eclipse and rise to the top of the equation. Knows, maybe this process has caused people, even within the GOP, the Republicans and the conservatives that seem to be most closely aligned on the political helm, maybe they're starting to see some credibility and pragmatism to coalescing around and about Santorum. So who knows, maybe people are taking a second look at the positions taken by Santorum, and maybe he's won the day. It's just fascinating how far we've come, where he was like a nobody, and yet he seems to be rising to the top, making headway. 16 point the state of Michigan is monumental. If Romney would even bother to stay in the race after such a shellacking had come to be, you have to wonder where the electorate is in all this. What is it saying? Why is it that media have been listening? Why are you going for someone? Why were we putting the egg into the Romney camp? Why did we decide the time to put behind Perry or Bachman or any of these other people? Why are we jumping the gun? Why don't we allow the public to speak before we actually speak for them? And what is it about the reporting process that causes one to want to jump on a horse as if that was going to be the horse that would take us to the end of the line? You know, you just got to wonder what's going on. And there are many things that seem not to be functioning as they should. But I guess what is important is that at the end of the day, those that espouse for Santorum are going to make themselves heard through the ballot box, and that is the only avenue of discourse and resolution that Americans have learned to create for themselves. We're not going to be fighting in the streets, killing one another, but we have the ability to cast a vote, which we should cherish to our dying day, and make sure that once we're dead that we don't come back to vote, which has been going on for too long. But the bottom line is most of us don't return to vote after we've died, at least not that I'm aware of, but I hear there are situations that that takes place. But the bottom line is while we're living, we should go out there and vote, cast our vote, state our positions by actually voting for somebody or voting for another somebody or voting for whomever we want. But the idea is to go out there and cast your vote in the hope that the person that you're voting for will actually be the person who has already reached out to you through whatever format, whether through listening to the content and their perspectives on television or on radio or in the discourse about them, whatever it happens to be, however you reach your conclusion, whether it be an advertisement or something else, the point is you really must engage in the process, take that extra mile, go and cast your vote, make your voices heard. So whether you decide that Santorum is not your guy or Santorum is your guy, then cast that vote. If you believe strongly that it's Romney that should be the standard bearer of the party and that he is the one that could win, cast your vote. Somehow or another, I feel that this process in the last few weeks with regard to the campaign, it's been such where the media tried to take control of the discussion of the election, driving people to believe that one thing would happen as opposed to another. But somehow or another, the public, the American public, has been quick to discern that they will not be so easily played, and they seem to have risen beyond the prognosis, beyond conjecture of the media and the media pundits. And the bottom line is they're heading out there to the polls, shocking the living daylights out of the pollsters who come up with numbers they probably have to do more than once or twice because they're in shock by the reality that they get in their polling process. So I'm not concerned that it may cost two or three times or whatever the polling companies to decipher what's readily available on the street by asking the person on the street how they feel about a particular position or how they feel collectively with regard to a particular candidate as opposed to another candidate or another or another. The point is that this is truly touching and mind-blowing because at the end of the day, we find that people are making up their own minds, not being driven one way or the other by the collective wisdom. And this will be fascinating. And just as Santorum seems to have moved 16 points beyond Romney in the polling with regard to the upcoming vote in Michigan, hey, if he's able to convince people who were not necessarily for him originally from the baseline of the the GOP and conservative parties, then he might be able to, or may have already stumbled upon, a mannerism, a form of decorum by which he addresses the public and reaches out to them. His way of expression, maybe the way he dresses, the way he looks, who knows? There may be so many elements that have driven support to him that he may or may not have known. He incorporates these aspects, these attributes that have caused him to make a stir on the political landscape, which is almost unheard of, I believe. Certainly seems to be making a charismatic move. Mind you, I don't listen to the Rush Limbaughs and all the CNN and MSNBCs and all those other things. That's for others to judge their value and so on. I try to make my own decision, try to ask people locally what they believe, what they think, and why they think it. Because it's important to know what locally we believe. What they may believe in Dallas, Texas is going to be different than what they believe in Juneau, Alaska, or Kennebunk, Maine. Or, I don't know, or Santa Fe, New Mexico. Or Phoenix, Arizona. It's certainly different than what we would expect to hear from Yonkers, New York, or Mount Vernon, New York, or Bronxville, New York. So it's important to stay locally in order to be able to have a better sense of knowing that your neighbor is in similar straits, similar circumstances than you and I. Some better off than others, but basically we're impacted by the same reality. And the question then becomes, which way are we going? And a poll that may have been conducted in Connecticut may not really be so impactful here. You know, you can't homogenize it at all. You know, whatever they do in Seattle, Oregon, is not going to necessarily be a harbinger of what's going to happen here. So, fascinating. We are literally at an exciting moment politically, because I believe that we are seeing a change. There is a schism between the mechanisms that have confined us to almost like a road or a path of winning or losing by the consensus built for us by media. And now, for some reason, it seems that there is a disconnect among that and the public, the voting bloc. And it will be interesting to see how that impacts the system. Because I think media will have to take a step back in order to be understanding of where they are and what they are and their role. It looks like we're having redefinitions on many, many fronts. Media is being redefined. And it will be interesting to see exactly where we end up. And it will not be the media that will make that decision. It will be the public that will make that decision for us. At the end of the day, and this is where quite often things are forgotten, is that the public rules and the public makes the decisions, and that everyone that works within that aspect of a democratically run nation will have to submit to the voter. And that's why it's so important for the voter to get out there and vote. That's why it's so important for the media to represent the voter as opposed to representing some dogma, whether it be Republican or Democrat or working family or independent or conservative or what have you. So, you know, these are the issues, and we're going to have a lot more time to discuss this. We'll have to see if we can get some more input with regard to what's going on. And until tomorrow, when we speak to Steve and Serato, we want to wish Bernadette Nayrog a happy birthday again. And those that will be celebrating Lent, we wish them an enjoyable Ash Wednesday. We welcome Timothy Cardinal Dolan back to America. And wish everyone a good day. So we'll speak to you tomorrow, and we thank you for joining us. Take care. And the weather's terrific. I don't know about you, but I almost feel like putting on my swim trunks, but I don't know if I'm ready to see myself in my swim trunks. Well, there you have it. That's a little bit more than you should know, but so it goes. Take care. Bye.